sale.
Waves, a program about sound art, produced by New Adventures in Sound Art for WGXC Wavefarm.
Good morning, this is the first thing.
And in this half hour,
now,
this morning, yes.
The National Research Council official time signal. The beginning of the long dash following 10 seconds of silence.
You were just listening to an excerpt from No Time for Silence by Victoria Fenner. This is the World Listening Day edition of Making Waves. No Time for Silence is a radio work that Victoria Fenner made for the CBC in 2000. We're playing it because recently it's been reworked into an audiovisual work created in collaboration with Stefan Rose. And that new work is called Seeing Sound, and it consists of three of Victoria Fenner's radio and sound art works from the early 2000s, and they've been combined with a video kind of score that works with it. And these will be shared on July 21st on a World Listening Day concert and screening at the Nascent North Media Arts Center, which also includes a piece by Claude Schreier, in which he's also bringing sound into an audiovisual realm through his Simple Soundscapes blog. We'll be talking to Victoria Fenner and Stefan Rose in the first hour. We'll be talking about their collaborative process and some of the insight into the decision-making that went into the piece. In the second half hour of Making Waves, we will celebrate World Listening Day by going on a walk with South River nature recordist Glenn Hubert. We'll learn how he records wolf howls on his property, which is about 30 kilometers west of the nearest paved road. World Listening Day occurs on July 18th every year, and it is an occasion for anyone and anywhere to go on a sound walk and discover the sounds that often go unnoticed from one day to the next. Visit worldlisteningproject.org for more details on how you can arrange a sound walk and share it with the rest of the world. Now we'll go to my interview with Victoria Fenner and Stefan Rose. And over the course of that interview, we'll listen to more of the pieces from the trilogy, which are The Queen of Bees and Looking for Light.
I've been doing sound works and sound art, specifically radio art, for probably over 20 years or so. And I've had people sometimes ask me, but what do we look at when we're listening to your pieces? And the thing is, it's funny because I've done sound festivals with you, Darren. I've had my works played on radio, and people who are really used to listening to sound on its own, this isn't a barrier for them, that there is nothing that for them to see. But for a lot of people, then it's really quite a foreign concept to listen to something without having something to look at. And so I got thinking about it, and I thought, well, what could I do to create an experience that was more inclusive for those people who are just not accustomed to listening to anything except perhaps music in the background? And so that's what I decided to do, was put together a project called Seeing Sound, which addresses the question, or attempts to address the question anyway, about how can we combine visuals and sound in a way where the visuals complement the sound and don't dominate the sound. I think that's been one of my one of my hesitations about working with video in the past is that the image is frequently really overpowering because we are a visual culture. And so how do I then create a sound work that is the sound, where the sound is the thing and the visuals is like the supporting cast in a way? And it's a very different approach for most of the video artists and video producer friends who I have. Usually they start with the image and then they add the sound. We did it the other way. We started with the sound and then with Stefan, the visuals were added.
Right. So Stefan, you've done stuff, videos to other music that's been made before. So you've worked this way of working with visuals to sound. That wasn't new to you in your collaborations with the Penderecki Quartet and others. How was this experience different?
Well, it was interesting for me in working with these pieces that they weren't all that, in some ways, weren't dissimilar from some of the works that I've created visuals to with the, for instance, with the Penderecki String Quartet, because some of their pieces, like Different Trains, was one that includes repetition of text that has been spoken in different ways. And so having pieces to work with that had audio of people speaking was not a real challenge. The real challenge was to find the conceptual framework for translating these audio pieces, which ranged in style from being very documentary in approach to abstracted kind of audio abstracted from landscape and abstracted audio from, you know, various sources. So it was the pieces were a little bit more of a challenge because of less sort of rhythm, or I'm not quite sure. I mean, there was less melody to sort of play off, you know, what kinds of things, you know, get repeated when, or, you know, how to create something conceptually that would go with the audio. I mean, a piece like Different Trains, for instance, is, you know, had been relating to the sound of trains and their function, you know, at different times during the war. But, you know, with a piece like Looking for Light, where it's got, you know, very subtle sounds from the landscape, you know, how do you take some of those things and then create a visual framework around that?
Victoria mentioned she wanted the audio and video to be on some kind of equal footing. So how did both of you achieve that?
What was interesting for me was when Stefan was talking about the pieces, you know, all being very different. I think that was a big challenge for Stefan. It was also a challenge for me trying to pick out which three of the some pieces that I've done over the past 30 years or so, which one. And so I very deliberately choose different. So the first one, No Time for Silence, which is one of the first pieces I ever did, is very much, it's probably the one that could be described as, I think when we were up visiting you, Darren, when we were putting it together, then Nadine, the managing director of NASA, she had said that it was like illustrated radio. And in a way it was. And it's like I've often been puzzled about in this new digital age where we're adding images to everything, how we can make radio visual. So that was very much a radio piece. The second one, The Queen of Bees, was inspired by a piece, by a line of poetry by London composer Penn Kemp. And it starts with, "The Queen of Bees had myriads to please." And it was a lovely line. And what we did was, it was a workshop where we were exploring how to turn poetry into sound art in London, Ontario in 2003. I didn't do the piece until about 2005. 5, so it was, you know, it's an older piece, but I let the sound sort of gel before I composed it. But what it is a dark fantasy, which is made up of some very unusual sounds, but trying to evoke the sound of a hive. And it isn't really, the piece isn't really about a hive. It's using the bees as the metaphor, exploring social organization and hierarchy and who has power and who doesn't have power, who wants it, how do they get it. So there are a lot of words in it, but there's a lot of sounds that are not really some traditional buzzing, as you'll hear, but we went beyond that and kind of imagined what bees sort of would have sounded like if we were to hear micro sounds, you know, that kind of thing. So, but it's very, very much a conceptual kind of piece exploring a central question, and that, and what is power? And so then the third one, Looking for Light, which Stefan referred to, was an interior journey and a very, very dark time. And I was exploring how do you get through that darkness and break into the light. So these were ideas that went beyond just sort of the mere sounds. It's like I sometimes refer to my works as documentary poetry, because they do have real life elements and real life sounds, but yet it's a poem. So I would imagine for someone who is trying to convey those kinds of concepts by sound, then it would have been quite a challenge. And Stefan and I had conversations every time we got together, which I recorded, about what we were thinking about the pieces and what the process is going to be, and just where our own artistic processes were going with each one. So it was really, really a marvelous collaboration, and I'm just really thrilled with the results.
And Looking for Light, the difficulty with the piece was both the subtlety of the sound, but then also conceptually about, you know, what is looking for light, you know, and Victoria gave some good descriptions of what were the influences on her work. But then for me to translate that into visuals, I spent a lot of time puzzling over how will I take imagery that, you know, looks towards the light, or that is being things that are influenced by light, because in my other realm outside of making video pieces, I'm also a photographer. And so, you know, that drawing with light is integral to my process. So, you know, was it going to be a photographic kind of based process of video imagery, or was it going to be something else? And I had initially started thinking about flowers because they're always looking for light and, you know, going up towards the light, you know, even turning, you know, some of them turning with the light through the day. And I was thinking, okay, how can I take these flowers, you know, so it's not just like macro photography? And then how do I, you know, what is it about these things? So I started building up a vocabulary of images that I was shooting of different plants at different seasons in different light, and then eventually I had so much stuff and started sifting through and finding the idea of it, or revealed itself to me, I would say, as I was looking through the footage. And then there were those surprises of, oh, I've got so many insects on so many of these plants, you know, that I hadn't really been paying very close attention to, because I was interested in the edge effects of plants and leaves and flowers, and, you know, thinking about something dangerous about, you know, what looks like a sharp edge very up close. So it was an interesting process over the 2-year span that we had our conversations and we were shooting, and then coming up with, you know, what fits together in the final assessment.
And one thing that was really, really interesting for me, the process, what I decided at the very beginning after our first conversation was I wanted to do one piece, which is No Time for Silence. I wanted to do that myself because another goal of the project was to start to do some of my own shooting and some of my own basic editing so that then I could do a lot of work on my own. So No Time for Silence was one that I did on my own. I decided with Stefan, it's like I thought, well, Stefan really needs a place where he can shine too, where he's not collaborating with me. So what he did was he did Looking for Light entirely on his own, showing me what he was coming up with. We talked about the concepts and everything like that. But other than that, I was very hands off. Third one, The Queen of Bees, was the one where we really put our brains together. And I would say that was the one that was the true collaboration between us. And the difficulty with The Queen of Bees is that whereas Looking for Light is probably about the most musical piece that I've ever done, and No Time for Silence is very much like sort of, I don't want to say documentary, but it does have documentary elements. The Queen of Bees is kind of like a radio play in a lot of ways, except that it's a radio play that has a very, very loose narrative. And I thought, how on earth are we going to do this? Because I don't want to do it with your stereotypical images of beehives and things like that, and bees buzzing around the garden and everything.
The Queen of Bees had myriads to please.
You know, because the more bees, the stronger the hive is.
We are disease bees.
There are new things here that we all must figure out how to apply.
We are disease bees.
There are new things here that we all must figure out how to apply.
Those are the workers. They do everything. Feed the drones, feed the queen, make the comb, gather the honey.
There's a lot of traffic going in and out of there.
Yeah.
If they couldn't get out, they would be having problems in the hive.
Come on. Come on.
Come here, little bee. Come here.
It was a collaboration not just between Stefan and I, but also my partner, Edward Mull, who has a really, really good visual imagination as well. We were talking about it at home, and he said, well, why don't you do it as like, kind of like Indonesian shadow puppets? And you could have like the bees, except, you know, you can only see the shadow of a bee. And so, and it won't really look like a bee. But so what he did was he took the ideas that we talked about and he created these bees that were like, they don't look like bees, but we played with them so that you could tell they were flying around like bees. And they were made of date pits with bamboo skewers like you would get satay on in a Thai restaurant. And he created a platform and we just experimented with the motion, and we took different bees and we flew them around in combinations of one or two, or sometimes whole flocks of bees. And Stefan came over and we actually rigged up a scrim in the studio with a nice piece of fabric over it. And we just did bee puppet. It was really, really crazy and fun. And that was the one where I think that it probably is a big departure from photography. And, It's the one I think that we probably had to stretch the most on, and the collaboration between the three of us, Stefan, Edward, and I, really, really yield some interesting results. I don't know, Stefan, if you have anything you'd like to add to that. I don't know what it was like for you.
Well, it was definitely a lot of fun, and for me, the great joy about putting together that piece was because there was the element of play to the collaboration. There was the sense that we could, you know, we didn't have boundaries, but also what I felt was important about the piece being very abstracted with these, you know, this shadow puppet play, was that it created a real abstraction from the very strong audio documentary type of piece that it has components of. So the interviews with the beekeepers talking about the role of the queen and the other bees in the hive and the interactions between, you know, that's, it's a very concrete description. And then you've got the poetic play of Penn Kemp's words and then the abstracted sounds of the bees imagined by the audio workshop participants. And then to take the visuals and instead of it being literal, taking it to an abstracted layer that allows the audio to really strongly come through, but still keep some visual interest.
Yeah, and I found of all of the pieces, that one was the most challenging because it was story-based and yet not story-based. It's sort of like, oh, and then the first bees did this, and then they did that, and then they did this. It's like, that's one of the challenges with this style of art that I do, I think, is that I am so firmly rooted in narrative, you know, coming from current affairs and radio drama and documentary and music too, but it's like primarily the spoken word arts. It was really, really a challenge to break through that and try to not portray what was happening in a very, very linear kind of way. And I got to share one of my favorite stories, though, from doing this one. This is really very funny. In talking about what my journey has been in terms of using my eyes and how this process has really, really woken up that sense in my, you know, of myself has really, really been wonderful. And I used to kind of joke around that the only reason why I had eyes was so that I didn't bump into posts while I was doing a sound walk. So anyway, so it's sort of like to say I haven't used my eyes to their full capacity is probably an understatement. But at one point I had put Ed had made the scrim to do the shadow puppets on, and I'd just done some test videos, and I sent them to Stefan, and Stefan got back to me and said, yeah, I like the texture, the backdrop that you're using, but could you iron it first so there's not a big wrinkle down the middle?
Yes, there's. Well, that's the great thing about collaborating with somebody who has practice in area when you're exploring a new place, is there's things they recognize or will, you know, certain attentions to detail that, you know, that you might take for granted. Are there ways, Stefan, that this project has stretched your audio perception as a visual artist and also as a writer?
I'm not sure that it has really stretched my perceptions so much as it's reaffirmed my love of audio in all forms. Because as you've noted before, I've done collaborations with other musicians, and I have a deep love of radio, and you know, as a poet as well, I, you know, like the way that Victoria has crafted these pieces. So, you know, the Queen of Bees has those poetic elements to it, from Penn Kemp's vocalizations and spoken words to the what I perceive as the flow of the audio piece. I mean, audio has been one of those things that I've always been fascinated by, but somewhat intimidated by, because I know people, I mean, Darren, I've known your work for a long time, and the fact that you can pick out some sort of frequency that's, you know, bothersome in a piece of audio, you can pick that out in an instant. And I'm like, I don't hear anything. What? but working on this project and getting a better sense of some of the poetic qualities in Victoria's editing has, I would say that's perhaps been giving me some confidence that maybe I can start making a transition to, you know, doing some of my own audio pieces as well as video.
You know, that's funny because it's like I am the opposite way. When I first started this, I mean, I've worked in television a bit. I've worked, you know, for video companies a bit, but mostly I've been at home in audio. And so for me, this has been a great confidence builder, and it's given me an opportunity to try some new ideas and also to work with Stefan and being able to ask questions about, you know, either why does that shot not look good, you know, and like he's able to say it doesn't look, you know, it could be better if you did this, and all the way from technical formats, you know, it's like what are the different codecs to save it in. It's like, it's for audio, there aren't quite as so many, it isn't as wide a range of different choices as far as the final encoding of the works. And the reason why I wanted to work with Stefan as well is because Stefan has been involved with New Adventures in Sound Art since 2001. Is it, Stefan?
Actually, since 2000.
Well, there you go. And so he's the official documenter for New Adventures in Sound Art. And there aren't a lot of video people who I would work with on this, because I find that, I don't know, it's the pictures always come first to so many video people who I know. And they don't intend for it to dominate, but it's like, I do think that there are many video artists who would really have a hard time really, really getting into the sound and really understanding that it is the sound that needs to drive their images and not the other way around. One thing I was very, very happy with is, I didn't think this would happen, and I'm really glad that it didn't, but I think there are some video artists who, if I had worked with, they would have asked me to change some of the sounds because they might have found images that would have gone better with different sounds. And Stefan never asked me to change a bit.
Certainly for me, respecting the artistic integrity of the piece that I'm working with has been one of the foremost things about my working process. So with previous collaborations, the pieces have been composed by, you know, quite well-known composers, and they are in some ways fixed in the way that they've been developed, because they're designed for, you know, concert environment. But also, I think from my experience of documenting concerts for New Adventures in Sound Art, or for Open Ears Festival of Music and Sound, or NUMIS New Music Concerts, whenever I'm documenting, that's been video as well as still images, I've had to develop a deep respect and consideration for the performers as they're doing their concerts, because to, you know, get up into their face with a video camera, or, you know, have that clicking shutter sound of the camera, a still camera, right in their face is going to distract them from what the end product is. So I've learned and developed a very respectful distance and care with how I document things. And I think that comes over into, you know, doing these kinds of collaborations with audio pieces that are carefully crafted in a studio setting, or, you know, carefully crafted right from the recording of the participants through to, you know, the production in the studio to create the piece. So, you know, I wasn't going to meddle in what that audio piece was going to be.
That was Victoria Fenner and Stefan Rose in conversation with me, talking about their work Seeing Sound, which will be shown at NASA in South River on July 21st. For the remainder of the program, we're going to go on a walk with local nature sound recordist Glenn Hubert. He has a property about 30 kilometers west of South River. It has a beaver pond nestled in a small forested valley, and it's the site of many wolf recordings that he's made in recent years. We went to the pond in hopes of hearing some wolves, and in the process, he shared his insight and passion for living and recording in the central Ontario wilderness.
So what we're walking on here is actually an animal trail that comes up and down from the pond up past the cabin. And so it's kind of marked out the area for us. It's all pristine land here.
So you're pointing to bear?
No, that's a bear scat.
Bear scat there?
Yeah, it's several days old. What we'll do is we'll approach the pond fairly quietly, just in case.
You
never know, there might be a moose or something down there.
Yeah.
No sign of Mr. or Mrs. Moose at the moment, but very serene and quiet down here. This is all untouched, pristine wetland. This is the beaver pond. And they made this dam here that we're about to walk on. Sure, if we'll catch a sign of Mr. Chucky the Beaver today.
What is his habits as far as time goes, like morning, evening, afternoon?
I think it depends on the time of year. We've seen him down here, especially early in the morning, working away, and then it seems like as the day wears on, we see less of him. And now, I don't see any sign of him. I'm not sure where his den is. I think his den is actually further down the wetland here.
Oh, okay.
As opposed to right here.
Mm-hmm.
The water is lower than it normally is.
I hear some wood snaps over there.
He's very skittish. He's not used to people being around at all, so. We were down here yesterday, and he did a couple of slaps with his tail, and then we didn't see him anymore.
So are the wolves attracted to the pond area if they come down for a drink of water and
stuff?
Yeah,
they actually use this beaver dam that goes, this is the main spot that will cross the whole wetland, you know, without getting waist deep in water. And especially, you know, in the spring and early summer like now. And so the wolves and the bear and the moose will use this dam as their path. You know, so the wolves also, in years when the deer aren't as plentiful, a lot of the deer go up to the nearby deer yard just north of us here. In those times when the wolves are here but the deer have moved on, they will actually stalk the beaver. They'll hunt the beaver.
Wow.
And and actually, from what I understand, even the bear will resort, if they need to, tearing a beaver dam apart to get at the den, you know. And but the wolves, yes, they come all through here, and I've heard them and recorded them many times. I'm pretty sure it's just all been on the far shore that I've heard them. Not, you know, they haven't come right at the cabin site. You know, where I haven't recorded them there, but I've had my microphones at the cabin recording and picked them up from here. And the ambience is just amazing, you know, because of the openness and whatnot. Okay.
From the perspective of the cabin up the hill, you mean?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. When I record, I never bait. I don't believe in it. I don't think it's ethical. Same thing, you know, for photographers, you know, just in order to get that close-up shot. When you hear photographers and you hear of photographers sometimes, you know, baiting owls and that kind of a thing. And of course, the owl becomes habituated to getting that morsel of food and a treat. And then next thing you know, it gets hit by a car, you know, and it's to the detriment of nature. So, I have a motto and I like to live by it. Nature should be appreciated, shared, and respected. It should be preserved, cared for, and protected for future generations. Mm-hmm. And if we can abide by that, appreciate it, we'll want to learn about it, we'll respect it, and then preserve and protect it.
You have the luxury of being here every day, so
yes.
You get to respond to it, which a lot of nature recordists are sometimes often kind of tourists that only pop into that place for
Weekend recordists.
Yeah.
Or
whatever,
that kind of a thing.
Or they keep moving to different places as opposed to being immersed in one place.
And that's what I have done for basically the past decade, doing exactly that, moving from location to location, seeking out different environments and habitats. And it's been very rewarding. It's also very time consuming, but very rewarding. And when we purchased this property, 40 acres, with the lay of the land and the pond feature and wetland, that was a major attraction, a major feature. And having the maple trees up on the ridge, the hardwood maples, and you know, all the coniferous and deciduous trees, just provides those different habitats. And you hear the frogs croaking and down here at the pond, and so you have all that habitat. And there's a cedar grove towards the front of our property, which again is a little different, you know. So big, you know, diverse piece of property, and lots of sounds, and it's really neat to, you know, we don't have loons on the pond, but when you hear the Canada geese coming in the spring, and, you know, heralding spring after a long winter, you know, it certainly is a welcoming sound. So with the wolves being in the area, to my knowledge and best of my ability to discern, I think there's about three packs of wolves that frequent the area. And from what I understand, they have, you know, about a 200-kilometer range and circle that they can do, like a routine. And it may take them a week or so to a week or two even to get back around, you know, to square one again type of a thing. Hmm. What I have found is that when I do hear them call, they usually are in the same location for a couple nights. That's my experience, you know, that I may hear them the very first night. And so the second night I'll set the mics out, and you know, if we're fortunate, then we'll get something. It's similar to fishing, right? Mm-hmm. You got to have your line in the water in order to catch the fish, and just because you're on a certain lake doesn't mean you're going to get the big one, right? Some days you get nothing, right? So, and it depends on the conditions, right? The fish don't always bite when it's real hot and sunny. They might like it during a rainy day, that kind of thing. So you know, same with the other wildlife like wolves and
the moose. Wolves, do they howl more or less in certain weather conditions, or is it more seasonal related to their?
I actually think that they don't howl as much or as often when it's windy and rainy. And I have had the mics out during those times, and very rarely have I had the occasion to be able to record them during like a windstorm or, you know, a rainstorm, that kind of a thing, which is kind of interesting. Now, I would think that perhaps that's because they know their sound doesn't carry as much when the wind's going through the leaves of the trees and there's so much background noise that, you know, their partners back at the rendezvous point may not hear them because the sound just doesn't carry as often.
And it's also, is it that they may not be hunting during those times?
It's possible, yeah, that's possible.
Or is it, I mean, is it always connected to hunting, or
It could be, because usually when the, you know, you have rainy season, rainy times, certain days where it's extremely windy and rainy, game and whatnot may not be out and about doing their regular, you know, their regular thing, so... you know, if they're all in their dens and hiding and keeping sheltered, then there's just not as much opportunity. And that's just a hunch, you know. It's maybe perhaps a wildlife biologist would know more. But that's just my hunch at this point. I do find that when it is a calm, clear night, I've had much more success with recording the wolves. And that's conducive to the recording too, right? Because there's not as much background noise and the ambience and echoes and reverberation is that much better when it's a nice, calm, still night. Like right now, you can see the pond is almost like glass and very protected down here from the wind and so forth.
You're also protected from... any kind of car noise from Eagle Lake Road, it seems like.
Yeah.
And or Rye Road.
Yeah. That's one of the other reasons why we chose this property is, you know, we're so far, you know, about, what, 20 miles away from any paved road and no train rumble, you know, with the recording. Low-end frequencies are often a problem. And personally, I don't like to have to filter out those low frequencies. I guess I'm a purist from that standpoint. I like to capture the sound as it is without or with very little doctoring and processing, you know, in post-production. So I try to choose the time and the place, the type of ambience that I'm after. And sometimes it's hit and miss, but I may go to the same location several times. And then when I finally do hear a wolf howl, for instance, I can judge what the ambience is like. And often the wolves will be in the same location another time. So, because, you know, they're creatures of habit. And they may find a certain location, for instance, in June, the pups are growing. So mama takes the pups into the edge of a field on the edge of a forest, and the alpha wolf with its, I don't know if it's just younger, you know, male counterparts in the team will go out on the hunt, leaving mama and the wolf cubs back at the rendezvous point, and that established rendezvous point will become often the place that is good to pick up on the wolves because mama stays, you know, in that same spot for the two or three nights that they're there before they move on, right? So they, I've noticed that around sunset, just around this time, maybe a little bit later in the evening as the sun is setting, they will howl. And I don't know if that is a call that, hey, we're going out on the hunt now, we'll see you later, kind of a thing. But usually around this time, you might hear them. And then maybe around 3 or even 4 a.m., you'll hear them again. And often what I've noticed is that the alpha wolf, as he approaches that rendezvous point, maybe a quarter mile away from it, he will give out, and I've noticed this quite a few times, the alpha will give out a single bark and then a howl and then wait. And then he'll give out another howl if he doesn't hear an answer back. He'll give out another howl, which is even more intense and a little more higher pitched. And then you'll hear mama usually answering back. And then
then the younger males that are in the hunting party will join in with the alpha, and then all the pups and whatnot will join in with mama. And next thing you know, as the hunting party with the alpha comes closer towards the rest of the pack, it gets more intense as they go. And I think it's just a greeting. Hey, we're here, mm-hmm. right? We're back, right? So, right. And it becomes a real family reunion, quite a cacophony of sounds. And the other thing that I've noticed too is that a lot of those sounds, like a single wolf can have three or even four types of calls, and they will do one after the other, yipping and yelping, and then a howl and a yip and a yelp and all these different sounds. So one wolf can sound like four. So a pack of
interchanging,
a pack of 12 is gonna, you know, could sound like 48 wolves, right? And it's like, wow, it really sounds like that's a huge pack, right?
Yeah. And if you can't see them,
So it leaves a lot to your imagination. And one of the things that I have done as I look back at the waveforms of the recordings, when I hear the alpha wolf, it'll almost have its own signature, which is different from, for instance, the main female of the pack. And I was fortunate enough in past years where we were living, which was on the edge of a farmer's field and the edge of a forest, and the pack would continually for about 3 years, 4 years, visit. Every 2 weeks or so for a couple nights. And so I got very accustomed to the sounds of that pack, the sound of the alpha wolf. And when suddenly there was one occasion where he didn't call anymore, and there was a new call that replaced him, and a much higher pitch, to just didn't sound like the alpha anymore. And I have a feeling the alpha, either he met his demise either from old age, because he was a big brute. He was very, very, very husky. And I did see him in the field, and he had a very deep voice. And suddenly he was replaced with a much younger sounding wolf that either drove him off, or perhaps the wolf was shot. The alpha, which happens, so often, especially when you're in farm country. But that was very interesting to note the changes in the pack over those years, and how many of the calls, the signatures, I could recognize. And I got so accustomed to hearing that male alpha wolf that when he was gone, I noticed it, so.
How often do you see the wolves, and visually, is it, do they keep their distance and you... You hear more than you see?
Very much so. They are so elusive. They I would say 99% of the time, they know you're there before you know they're there. Mm-hmm. They're very well aware with their hearing and sense of smell what's going on in the area. And I have had occasion where I've had up close and personal encounters a couple of times. And I felt very privileged and honored to be able to witness that. One day it was just about pre-dawn. It was probably 4:30 in the morning, and it was early July. And I wanted to record the babbling of some streams. So I headed out into the back roads, parked the vehicle, and I walked about a half a kilometer. And I followed this little creek through the, winding through the bush. And I found a place where the babbling was felt right for me. And I set my microphone down. So I just wanted to get a nice soundscape of the babbling creek. So I walked away from the microphone so it could record in quietness. So I was out of earshot of the microphone. And I just knelt down at the creek, and I was just playing with some pebbles in the water and kind of rearranging them and just killing time and just enjoying the dawn. And the birds were just starting to wake up, and the creek was only about two feet wide, 3 feet wide at most, and I felt the presence of something. I felt like I was being watched,
You know that feeling you get? And so I glanced up, and lo and behold, from here to that tree away was a wolf staring at me. And he was big. And I was crouched down, and I froze in awe that, you know, first thing is you think a dog, and then, no, I'm out in the middle of a bush. There's no way that's a dog. And then I realized, no, that is definitely a wolf. And he was looking at me, and he was across the creek. And so I froze in my tracks and just stayed there. And he came closer toward the creek, but not toward me, kind of sidestepped me, knowing I was there. And so I got up, and I wanted to make myself big because I didn't really feel a threat. You know, I wasn't feeling threatened from him, but I just wanted to make sure he knew I was there and that I wasn't going to be prey, right? Not that I think that they
you
would.
You might have been vulnerable, crouched over.
Yeah, maybe vulnerable, right? Mm-hmm. So my feeling is that wolves are not going to attack a person, you know, who's just out walking. It's got to be some circumstances that really, you know, provoke that kind of a situation. You look up the number of times that, you know, man and wolf have had really bad encounters. Very far and few between, right? So anyways, I stood up, and the wolf jumped across the creek on the side that I was on. He half glanced over at me, and he continued to walk on up a hill, up a ridge, and I turned around and just in awe, just watched him go up to the top of the hill, and he stopped. And at that point, I thought, okay, he's at least 150 yards away from me. I'm in a safe distance now. So I gave it a howl just to say hello. And he turned and he looked, and all of a sudden he howled back and he went over the ridge and he was gone. It was just an amazing encounter. Just amazing. I felt, you know, so blessed and honored that I could experience that, right? So if you want, I'll try to do a little. I'll do a little howl out there if you want. See if there's anything in the area. And you never really know if there's going to be one within earshot. And but a number of times we've been very surprised.
Do you try and learn their calls? The particular pack here?
Actually, I that male alpha wolf that I told you about that had been around our place so often that I had recorded so many times, I actually studied his calls and mimicked his pitches and stuff like that. And I've adapted that so much that sort of becomes my wolf howl, my song. And so I stick with that. Now, just for your listeners, in case they try to do wolf howls, try not to do wolf howls in the spring. Anytime after, you know, the end of February into March and April, and even into parts of maybe May, because the female wolf will have pups at that time. And if you howl and the mother hears that, she may feel threatened that there's another wolf in the area that they're not familiar with, and she'll actually take her pups out of the den and relocate them. So, you know, if you enjoy hearing the howls of the wolves, you're doing a disservice at that time of year by howling and then making the pack move on, right? So in the spring right through till about, I figure by the first week of June, I'm fairly safe that, you know, the pups have been reared and they're out of the den now, and they're able to move around on their own, and so they're not as much of a threat if they do hear another wolf or a person howling like a wolf, you know. So, but the wolves really, they respond to frequency. And I think it's the frequency of the long note that triggers something inside of them that they're compelled.
So do different alpha wolves hold that frequency of different pitches? Like, yes. If that's kind of germane to that wolf?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I would say, with my experience that I've heard, the pitches that on different packs are different. The male alpha wolf will have his own song, and that's how I think the rest of the pack identifies that. Oh, this is the alpha calling. They know his voice, right? And I'm sure with their hearing and everything, that their hearing is, you know, much more sensitive than ours, so they would be even more sensitive to those rises and falls in the pitches, right? So there may be two wolves that do sound similar because they speak the same is it dialect or mm-hmm. you know that kind mm-hmm. of a thing, but they know the difference, almost like when somebody has an accent from a different region, right? So I think they're really tuned in to the voice, and that's why when they do hear an unfamiliar call, that is something that's okay. That we've got to be careful here because the wolves are competitive, and sometimes there may be a lone male wolf come in to either invade a pack or to try to curtail the numbers in breeding or try to breed with the females.
Right, so, okay. Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to call twice, and that's after that, that's all I call. I only call two times, and the once is my hello, I'm here. The second time is kind of repeating that in case they're in case they couldn't hear something, you know, that they're busy doing something, that the second call will catch their attention if the first one doesn't. And in my mind, there's no point in doing a third call. So I'll see what I can do here. I'll just walk a few yards out into the mm-hmm. onto the beaver dam here, out into the open where the sound will carry a bit more, and we'll see that. It's a white-throated sparrow. Do you hear that? Beautiful call. I love that call.
Well, the squirrel answered you.
Yeah, squirrel answered. Now, that doesn't mean that they're not here. They just may choose not to answer.
do you find, what are some of the differences between summer and winter as far as the soundscape goes, and what your ears get interested in?
Yeah, for wolves in particular, I've actually found it very difficult to get many howls in the winter, and I have a feeling that it could be because of the deer yards that are around. They know where the food is, and they kind of travel with it, right? So I think that has a lot to do with it. And it could be because the snow is just so deep, and, you know, their food sources may not be as plentiful as it would be in the spring, summer, and fall here. So they move on to, you know where they're going to get fed, right? So, and they know the area that, you know, so well. As I say, you know, a 200-kilometer range, they know what spots are working for them and when, you know, that kind of a thing. Same with the rest of the wildlife. I've come down to the pond some days.
C, C is for...
Cauliflower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K is for...
Kitten.
Cam.
C, wait. Fianrupsi. U, unbearable.
U is for underground.
Oh, yeah.
Umbrella.
T. Trite.
Tremendous.
Torment.
Tire.
C, K.
I can't think of a U one. T.
T.
F is for famous.
Fun. Fumble. M is for... Montreal.
Do you know about love? What do you possibly think you know about love? You know, I'm sick and tired of men using love like it's some kind of disease you just catch. Love should have brought you home last night.
Welcome to the spot.
Welcome to the spot.
The spot is where I kick it.
Got a lot on my mind, I'm thinking I need
you. Bring me joy when I'm down. Also,
oh, that's great. Oh yes, Montreal. Welcome, welcome to the spot on CKUT 90.3 FM. The spot is where I kick it. I'm your host.